Thanks so much for having me. I've had a lovely time so far. The work that I'm presenting today is really new work for me. And one of the ways that it's new is that I'm trying to bring a background I've got in art history. So I also did a PhD in art history as well as philosophy. And work in aesthetics, which is one of the fields in philosophy that I primarily work in. I'm just going to use aesthetics for aesthetics, philosophy of art, that field. And feminist philosophy. I'm trying to bring these all together and get them to speak to each other in ways that I feel like they haven't so far. Certainly they haven't for me. And I want to say that I begin by talking about these some dissatisfactions I have with the anti-porn feminist literature. But that is coming from someone who identifies with that literature and identifies herself as an anti-porn feminist. So it's very much like from within that perspective that I say anything critical. So it's I want to make that clear. Okay, so I'm going to begin with these two dissatisfactions that I have with anti-porn feminist literature and a lot of analytic feminism in general, really, I would say about this. First, by far, most philosophers today construe pornography as a linguistic phenomenon, one that can be analyzed using tools and methods from the philosophy of language. As you know, this has produced a profound body of work that has moved feminism forward in many ways. But it's still curious in that by far most contemporary pornography takes the form of pictures, moving and still. And I'll say something very similar could be said about the scant philosophical literature on propaganda. So I don't know how many of you know Jason Stanley's recent book, but he just outright says at the very beginning, I'm not going to talk about what he calls representations, which is clear he means pictures. He just says, I'm only interested in arguments and pictures only insofar as they support them. And he doesn't discuss a single picture in the whole book, much less reproduce one. So this problem arises in various places. I think this isn't a minor problem. Not only is it generally agreed that pictures represent the world in ways that are different from the ways that language represents the world. So the term that we use for this in the philosophy of art is depiction. And I don't mean to suggest that there's a uniform account of depiction. There's definitely not. But even the people who have the most kind of linguistic-y accounts of depiction still think that it's different from the ways that language represents. So there's not just that, but also pictures have what I'll call an extra depictive aspect or extra depictive features that are distinct, at least conceptually distinct from what they depict. Things like design that bear on the properties that the pictures attribute to the things that they depict, and also to the responses that the pictures solicit or call forth from their viewers. So this is a thought I'm going to develop here. As I'll try to convince you today, pictures often work in ways that are quite different from language. And it's my conviction that understanding the ways that pictures work will give us a better handle on understanding how pornography works, or at least understanding a dimension of pornography, I really should say. And in particular, on its role in sustaining gender inequality, and I think this will help us. This will help us do this better than if we just focus on language alone. So to jump ahead of things a little bit, I hope to show that a shift to the pictorial allows for a better understanding of the persuasive power of pictures, of pornographic pictures in particular, but also advertising and propaganda. That's the kind of bigger picture thing I'm interested in. But today I'm going to focus on pornography, both in terms of what pornography persuades us of and in terms of the mechanisms, how it persuades us. Okay, my second dissatisfaction is that in analyzing pornography's harmful effects, anti-porn feminists tend to focus on the nefarious falsehoods that pornography leads its audiences to internalize. For instance, beliefs about female inferiority, rape myths, and so on. And while I don't disagree with the idea that false beliefs play a significant role in sustaining women's subordination, and while I accept that the predominant forms of heterosexual pornography may well lead their audiences to internalize various falsehoods, I'm with Professor Langton when she urges that our discussions of pornography need to move, as she puts it in her essay, beyond belief. A really important essay, I think, from, I don't know, 2012, 2013. Feminist accounts of pornography must, I think, give more attention to the role of the affective life in sustaining sexism, and in particular, more attention to pornography's effects on what I shall call, a little bit later in this paper, erotic taste. But if we are to move beyond belief, I think, we also need to move beyond language and start thinking about pictures. And in particular, the pictorial dimension of pictures is what I'm going to try to bring to focus here. And I think that doing that means drawing from other fields like art history and visual studies. So that's some of what I'm going to try to do. Okay, so this is the first section of this paper, the sentimental persuasion section that I'm going to get to right now. So I suggest that we conceive of pornographic pictures as engaging in the art of persuasion. Let us say that to persuade is to influence a person's attitudes towards something, and I've got this on your handout in some form. To influence a person's attitudes towards something in such a way that she accepts the attitudes in question and comes to find the thing toward which the attitudes are directed to warrant the attitudes. So I'm saying that to persuade is to influence, but not determine. Because the possibility of resistance and the notion of assent and endorsement are central to the concept of persuasion. So to see what I mean, consider a contrast case wherein I manipulate your brain via electrostimulus to induce you to accept that climate change is real. I will have influenced your attitudes, to be sure, but I will not have persuaded you. In persuasion, the persuadee assents to and accepts the pressure of the vector of influence. So there are, of course, different types of persuasion depending on the sort of attitude that is influenced. So a persuasive argument for some proposition gives good reasons for you to believe the proposition. So that's the attitude aimed at belief. A different form of persuasion aims at what I call the sentimental realm. And here I mean to construe the concepts sentiment broadly in a kind of 18th century way, to include various affect-laden, object-directed mental states like emotions, desires, and some feelings and pleasures. And so I'm using this broad term because I don't want to get involved in what I think is a very interesting debate about what constitutes an emotion and how they're different from feelings and so forth. I'm gesturing at all of that, but without engaging in that debate. So here I want to emphasize that our sentimental life is populated not just by occurrent affective attitudes, but also by habits and dispositions to feel in particular ways. And this is a little bit looking forward to the third section of the paper where I'll talk about taste, which I understand is a disposition to feel certain evaluative sentiments regarding things. And I'll explain that more in a bit. Okay, there are two more points I want to make here about sentiments. First, many, maybe all, but all I need for right now is many sentiments are evaluative to some degree. So to find a dish to be delicious, for example, is to have reasons to praise the dish, to admire the chef, and of course, to eat the dish and savor it while doing so. Similarly, one might say, to find a kind of sex act to be erotically exciting and desirable is to be given reasons to praise it and to pursue it. So that's the first thing, the evaluative dimension. The second thing that I want to note is that sentiments, unlike beliefs, don't, even in the paradigmatic cases, yield, or anyway, don't readily yield to argument and rational deliberation. You can make all sorts of convincing arguments for why I oughtn't love bacon, but these will do little, if anything, to dislodge my special fondness for bacon. Similarly, if my erotic taste is focused on, say, female disempowerment, convincing arguments about what's wrong with this will do little, if anything, to change my desires. I'm going to come back to this this notion of norm discordance is one way of putting this in the third section of this paper. Our sentiments, Aristotle famously said, yield to force, not reason. No, it's not clear to me anyway exactly what he meant to that, by that, and it's certainly not obvious that you can force someone to like something. But I have an idea of how to make sense of this. We might interpret Aristotle as gesturing at what I'll call sentimental persuasion. And even if you don't think this is the right way to interpret Aristotle, I hope to convince you it's the right way to think about pictures, and in particular, how pornographic pictures do their work. But when I think about Aristotle here, I'm really thinking a lot about the politics, the rhetoric, and the poetics as a kind of, in thinking about sentimental persuasion. Sentimental persuasion is the influence, so here I'm kind of putting what I say on the handout about persuading and sentiments together. Sentimental persuasion is the influencing of a person's sentiments and dispositions to sentiments towards something in such a way that she comes to accept the sentiments in question and comes to find the thing toward which the sentiments are directed to warrant the sentiments. Sentimental persuasion rather than argumentation is what is needed to get me to stop loving bacon, for instance. And so looking forward to a future section of this paper, I'll argue that sentimental persuasion is what is needed to bend erotic taste toward gender equality. I mean to suggest today that sentimental persuasion is the right way to understand what pictures can do, or if you prefer, much of what we do with pictures. It's a primary locus of their tremendous power, and it's something to which I think pictures are especially well suited. Speaking of the power of pictures, I have a little quote there for you from an art historian named David Friedberg, who begins his really interesting book on the power of images, talking about the power of pictures, and I really like that. So this is the locus of their tremendous power. Putting these two thoughts together, it's my view that in their capacity to persuade sentimentally, and in particular to shape their audience's erotic taste, that pornographic pictures play an important role in sustaining gender inequality. This, I think, is the best model for formulating one of anti-porn feminism's central worries, namely that imaginative engagement with inegalitarian pornography, I'll have more to say about what that is in a minute, but let's say a certain kind of pornography, the dominant form of heterosexual pornography, that imaginative engagement with inegalitarian pornography can deform audiences' erotic taste in favor of women's subordination. It can make women's subordination sexy. But on my view, this conviction in what you might call the social power of pornographic pictures ought to commit anti-porn feminism to championing alternative forms of pornography that persuade in the other direction to find gender equality sexy. So that's, I'm going to turn to that thought very briefly at the end of the paper. Okay, now I'm moving to the second section on pictorial rhetoric. So before I outline what I think is the right model of pictorial persuasion, I'd like to very briefly turn to an example that will highlight some of the peculiarly pictorial means of persuasion that I think will eventually help us see why we should focus on the pictorial when thinking about pornography. So this is what you had to wait so long for me to get together to show you. Can you see that? It doesn't look to me like so much lovely light.
You can turn the contrast on.
Yeah. We don't judge you for that, just so you know.
I think it's just, it just needs to warm up. Yeah.
Oh, it needs to warm up. Oh, there we go. So this is Titian's rendering of Tarquin and Lucretia, and it is here in the Fitzwilliam, and I have not yet seen it, but I hope to see it tomorrow. And it's really, I think it was painted in 1570 or 71 or 72, anyway, quite late in Titian's career, and it's a painting about which Titian said it like cost him the greatest labor, and it's considered like one of his really important paintings. So here's the story. The man pictured there in the red is Sextus Tarquinius, and he's the son of a tyrant king, and he comes into Lucretia's bedroom. Lucretia is a Roman matron who's known for her beauty and her virtue. And he comes into her bedroom and he threatens to kill her if she doesn't give in to his sexual desires. And she, being the virtuous Roman matron that she is, refuses. And so he makes another threat, and he says he will kill her, and he will kill, depending on whose story, his slave or her slave, and then lay their bodies next to each other naked and tell her husband that, and everyone, that he killed them both. He found them in an adulterous embrace and killed them, which is apparently an appropriate punishment for finding someone in an adulterous embrace. So then she gives in. And the next morning, she tells her husband and her father what's happened, and she demands that they, she demands vengeance, and then she commits suicide because she, because of her shame and because of her having been sullied. And so there are two moments in Lucretia's story that typically, in the history of art, that get depicted. One is this one, and the other is the moment where she's stabbing the knife in her breast as a paragon of virtue, having taken her own life. And the other part of the story, the last part of the story, is that her husband and father and some other men get really outraged, and they overthrow the tyrant king, and they found the Roman Republic. And so this is so Livy is the classic source for this, and this is one of the stories of the founding of the Roman Republic. Another is the rape of the Sabines, and they interestingly both have rape as a kind of central bit of the founding of the Roman Republic, of the founding of the nation story. So that's the story. That's what the painting depicts. The moment, the beginning of the physical assault. So that's what the painting depicts, but what the painting does is eroticize this moment. By which I mean the painting presents the sexual assault in such a way as to render it sexually exciting for the viewer. Or a different way of putting this is the painting entices the viewer to find this assault on Lucretia to be erotically titillating. The painting does this in a bunch of different ways, so I'm going to just talk very briefly about it. But one is in the contriving to reveal her body in a sexualized way. So I think it's really important when we look at a painting like this that we should never take it for granted that she's naked and facing us in a way that shows off, you know, the erotic goods in a way that's, you know, especially flattering to them and such. So there's no narrative reason for her to be naked. There's no narrative reason for her to be posed in this way. But that's part of the address of the pictures, to show us her her body. And, you know, so less so than other paintings, I'm going to show you one more. You don't see all of her breasts, and you don't see all of her pubic region, but it's quite suggestive, and there are little peaks of them here, of both of her breasts, and of the, what we call the pubis, you know, the kind of triangular region there with the shadow, slight suggestion of pubic hair, which at this time was, you know, taken as a very sexualizing thing to show. Most women are depicted without any pubic hair because it's taken to be the kind of, that's the really like, that's considered a very licentious kind of thing to render someone with pubic hair. So that's one. Another is, and so I haven't seen this painting, but I know Titian. I wrote my dissertation on Titian, and I can just tell you, Titian is a past master of this, of conjuring this kind of panoply of sensual textures. The bed, the different bed draperies, the drapery over her, and importantly, the creamy, glowing flesh. And so Titian famously painted with these very thin layers of oil, and would build up layers of translucent oil to get a kind of glowing, radiating surface so that the light can kind of penetrate through some of the layers, and so they have this kind of gem-like quality. That's an important bit of the flesh, for which Titian was famous. He was really famous. At this point in his life, in 1570, he's known throughout his world for being the person who can really conjure beautiful female flesh, unlike anybody else. That's one of his big things. And another important thing, and I didn't include a slide to show you this, but I promise you it's true, is that Lucretia here looks exactly like all of Titian's Venuses. This is at this point in time, that's an iconic face for the goddess of love. Everything, the earrings, and all of that. And something that people started commenting on very soon after this painting was painted, that her, like, Venus's beauty is heightened by her fear. So there's this kind of made all the more lovely by her fearful expression, which I think is a really important kind of trope in eroticizing depictions of rape throughout the history of art and also in literature. So there's much more to say about the painting, of course, but those are some of the key features. For the moment, we can come back to it, but for the moment, I want to just say, I couldn't resist. I do want to just show you very briefly. Here's another Titian representation of rape.
This is the one that Daisy discussed to me in this very meeting 2 weeks ago.
Oh, did you talk about this one?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, yeah. So there's more to say. There's much more to say about this one. And this painting eroticizes in different ways, but there's a whole tradition. Titian did many such. This one belongs to a series of mythological rapes by the gods. So Tarquin and Lucretia has this kind of like quasi-historical character to it. But anyway, I just wanted to show you that one. I hope we get to come back to that too. So for the moment, I just want to insist that the eroticization of rape here consists not in the mere expression of the proposition, say, rape is sexy, or not a command, like, find rape to be sexy. Rather, what the picture does is conjure what Elizabeth Camp calls a perspective. In this case, a strongly eroticizing perspective of rape. A perspective in Camp's sense is more than the endorsement of a collection of propositions. A perspective on a thing patterns our attention to that thing, in particular by assigning salience to some of the thing's properties. So, for instance, thinking about her body and which bits of it get visual focus. And structures not just our beliefs about that thing, but importantly, guides our sentimental and evaluative responses to the thing. Persuasively conjuring perspectives is something the pictures in general do especially well, precisely because they offer a first person and extremely vivid view of things, and it's a view that in which the things are made to merit robust emotional and evaluative responses. So Titian's picture doesn't endorse the proposition that rape is erotic or some set of imperatives, rather it coaxes and seduces us to feel almost firsthand some of the erotic delights of this scene of sexual subordination. It makes rape appear erotic, or differently put, the picture entices us to find rape to appear to warrant an erotic response, to be worthy of an erotic response. So this eroticization of rape is something that Titian's painting shares with some pornography. And while rape porn is just a fraction of the pornography out there, it belongs to a larger and much more widespread category that I've elsewhere characterized as inegalitarian porn. Inegalitarian pornography eroticizes acts, scenarios, and postures characterized by gender inequality. And I want to insist here that this is a spectral phenomenon. So a range from the more extreme scenarios where women are violated or mistreated or humiliated to the less severe, more mundane, more commonplace kinds of scenarios of sexual objectification, where women are presented merely as the objects of men's desires, but never themselves as subjects of desire, where women are shown as passive recipients of sexual acts, the thing that is penetrated, rather than as an agent, as an actual sexual agent, the thing that invaginates or envelops or something, figuring the female part as active there. where men's sexual pleasure is at the center of the narrative and the picture, visually at the center, while authentic women's sexual pleasure is almost never shown. So these are that's the sort of other end of the spectrum. Another thing that Titian's painting shares with inegalitarian pornography is the fact that the perspective so seductively conjured is masculinist, one that doesn't just allow a male viewer to project himself into the scene, but one that beckons to and entices him to find this scene of female disempowerment to be erotic. I mean to offer Titian's picture as an example of what I'm calling sentimental persuasion. And now I'd like to make some more general remarks about pictures and how they persuade sentimentally. So here's a really quick tour through how I think pictorial rhetoric works. And I put this on your handout too, because it's a lot of material and I'm passing through it rather quickly. So a picture's means of persuading sentimentally is what I'll call pictorial rhetoric, the peculiarly pictorial means by which a picture aims to persuade its audience of a perspective according to which certain kinds of sentiment are appropriate to certain kinds of object. I use teleological language here on purpose. Pictorial rhetoric aims to have certain effects on its audience, but whether a picture succeeds in this is another matter, and I'll talk more about that in a minute. When I speak of aims here, I mean to attribute them not to the picture's artist, but rather to the picture itself. I should just say, so I have strong, what we call in the philosophy of art, anti-intentionalist commitments. So I prefer to think about aims as something that the object has, and I have a way of explaining that. But if you're an intentionalist and you prefer that way of going, everything that I say here is still available to you. So this is just, I'm just giving you my way of cashing out aims that don't rely on the artist's intention. But if you like artist's intention, that's you could go that way. Okay, so a picture can properly be said to have aims insofar as it prescribes responses. In this case, sentimental responses. In saying that pictures prescribe, I mean not the absurdity that pictures come with instructions, you know, like take 2 tablets with water or something like that. Rather, I mean that pictures present objects in such a way as to warrant, to be worthy of, a kind of response. And in the philosophy of art, there are a whole bunch of people who use the term prescribe to, in different ways, to talk about responses that are called for. I actually prefer a term like solicit, or lure, or coax, but prescribe is the kind of standard way of talking about it in the literature, so I'm using it here. Okay, so pictures almost always represent objects, and by that I just mean the things that they depict, by making salient certain features or aspects while de-emphasizing or even eliminating others. Sometimes these features or aspects of things will be cues for kinds of sentimental response. A cue, on my view, is a feature that the picture's target audience takes to warrant the response in question, where the target audience is the group that the picture addresses. So, for instance, this is one way of thinking about what one means when one says the male gaze, that the target audience of a picture characterized by the male gaze is a particular, I would say not male, but rather masculinist kind of subject that could be inhabited by people that we call women or men. Either way, I don't think it's something peculiar to men. I think that's the wrong way of thinking about it. But anyway, that's the idea of the target audience there. Elements of pictorial rhetoric, that is, dimensions of pictures that cue particular kinds of sentimental response, include, and so this is my very quick little list, formal features, composition, color, line, texture, value. When we talk about value in the visual arts, we mean black and white. Not good and bad, but that's just the way of distinguishing that from hue. So formal features, and this is what I meant about feeling that art history and visual studies have a lot to offer here, because that is the place where one really gets training and how to learn how a picture is put together and what it's trying to do in terms of the form, these kinds of formal elements. So that's one. Intertextuality is another element of pictorial rhetoric, reference to established and rhetorically forceful pictures. So I think one example in the picture that I just showed you is, you know, when I said, by the time Titian painted this Tarquin and Lucretia, this was an iconic face. There's a kind of reference to a whole body of work that Titian has built up at this point that pictures Venus in a very particular way. Association, connecting a depicted thing with other depicted things that are already sentimentally charged. So those are just three that I think are main elements of pictorial rhetoric. These elements of pictorial rhetoric assign salience to certain features or aspects of depicted content while diminishing others. So as I've been saying all along, pictorial rhetoric aims to produce certain responses, but whether the picture succeeds in producing these responses is another matter entirely. There will always be failures for the prescribed responses to obtain. Sometimes these failures will be due to the picture. Other times they'll be due to the audience. So just for example, I'm a 21st century feminist and I'm not going to have the sorts of responses to Tarquin and Lucretia that the picture aims to provoke. But I can nevertheless identify that the picture has these aims. And there's a kind of failure to produce that response, but that failure lies probably mostly with me, and calling it a failure isn't to say that there's something wrong with my subject position. It's just that I'm failing to, that the response is failing to obtain, is all I mean by that. And I think there's a real interesting connection between what I just described and the thing that Tamar Gendler calls the won't form of imaginative resistance. You know, so it's not that you're unable to imagine the thing that you're prescribed to imagine, but that you won't for various moral reasons. Okay, so I'm going to sum up this view really quickly about pictorial persuasion. Pictures persuade not so much by expressing propositions as they do by conjuring perspectives. A perspective is a first-person view of some depicted object, where this object is presented as warranting certain sentimental responses. Pictorial rhetoric is the means by which the picture prescribes these responses. It's their means of persuading us to feel in certain ways. Pictorial rhetoric involves bringing form and content together, along with other things like association and intertextuality, to cue the target audience to respond to depicted elements in particular ways. Pictorial rhetoric aims at what I'm calling our sentimental landscape, at shaping the audience's feelings and emotions, our sympathies, our antipathies, our desires, our disgusts, fears, and hopes. And this, I think, is a very important part of how pornography does its work, thinking about these kinds of things. Okay, so now I'm moving to the next section on erotic taste. So I began my discussion of pictorial rhetoric with Titian's picture in order to illustrate a general point about pictorial persuasion. The point I've suggested isn't limited to the realm of high art. Well, maybe I haven't suggested that in the short version of this, but I'll just tell you now, it's not at all limited to high art. I think it's an important part of advertising for sure, and for propaganda, as well as pornography. Titian was a past master of pictorial rhetoric, but we ought not underestimate the persuasive power of all sorts of pictures, like advertising and in religion and propaganda. Through skilled manipulation of pictorial rhetoric to persuasively conjure a vivid and enticing perspective, a picture can bring us to feel in quite determinate ways about the things depicted. They can get us to see a new style of sunglasses as sleek or chic, a new automobile as sleek, a god as awesome and venerable, a group of foreigners as threatening, and so forth. As I've said earlier, it's not just that we're made to feel in a certain way. This isn't just a causal claim. But pictures bring us to see the depicted objects as warranting sentimental evaluative responses, thereby generating desires, I think, in the first instance. And this is where I think advertising is really useful to think about here. So I just need to push the right thing. There we go. So here's my example from advertising. High-waisted jeans are back. You knew this, I'm sure. They've been back for a while. And, you know, we were living with low-waisted jeans for like a decade. So it takes a while to come to see high-waisted jeans as something other than what we call mom jeans. I'm a mom. I never wore mom jeans, so this is probably a bad stereotype. But anyway, I myself am still struggling. I don't own a pair yet. I still have trouble looking at them and seeing them as. But my students are all over it. They're done with the low-waisted jeans, and it happened just like that. And so I'm interested in the way that pictures can get us to shift our taste and come to find this desirable. Right, not catering to some desire that I already had. One of the really interesting things about advertising, how good advertisements can generate desires. And I think this is a really great way of thinking about pornography as well. So you might say, oh, well, this is all very interesting, but aren't these ultimately matters of mere taste? To which I say, yes, but I want to resist the mere. As I've already intimated, I think that analytic feminism, I can take the jeans off now. I should be distracted by the jeans. As I've already intimated, I think analytic feminism mistakenly tends toward a kind of intellectualism that privileges belief and overlooks the role of taste in sustaining social inequalities. I mean, I think your Beyond Belief essay is the one outlier there, and it is why it's such an important essay. In particular, I urge that we attend to the ways that the socially predominant forms of erotic taste promote and sustain gender inequality. So by erotic taste, so I have some more definitions here for you on the handout. By erotic taste, I mean a person's standing disposition for erotically inflected evaluative sentiments regarding something where these sentiments are partially or fully constituted by or based on pleasurable or displeasurable responses to a thing's sensible properties. That was a mouthful. That stuff about constituted by or based on partially or fully, I'm not being wishy-washy there. There are just a bunch of debates in aesthetics about pleasure and whether it's the grounding of aesthetic judgment or it's constitutive or, you know, this kind of thing. And I just want to say, like, whatever you want to say there. I think it's fine, whichever of those you take, for my purposes here. So I'm just trying to not get into those debates. I mean to construe the concept erotic quite broadly here to include a person's sexual taste, so positive and negative preferences for things like sex acts or orientation towards certain kinds of partners, but also to extend to one's general sense of what makes a person sexy or even simply attractive. Feminists, I think, need to attend to erotic taste for many reasons. First of all, when you consider that an inegalitarian sex and eroticism admits of degrees, as I mentioned earlier, this kind of spectral notion, you find, I think, that inegalitarian erotic taste is quite widespread, that in the milder forms, heterosexual erotic taste strongly tends to eroticize dominance for men and submissiveness for women. And I think, again, thinking about it as a spectral phenomenon makes that clear. Second, for most people, the erotic plays a central role in life, whether consciously and explicitly or not. Third and related, erotic taste is highly motivating, typically activating all sorts of behavioral tendencies. And fourth, erotic taste is typically norm-discordant. This is a point I made earlier with respect to sentiments. That is, being out of joint with our moral convictions or with what we know to be true does little to dislodge our erotic likes and dislikes, our desires and antipathies. Indeed, many people are even averse to subjecting their erotic taste to rational and moral scrutiny in the first place. It's hard enough to have an erotic life, much less be scrutinizing it all the time, many people would say. This can make the sort of erotic taste that centers on inegalitarian sex and on women's subordination to men especially intransigent and resistant to change. But to say that inegalitarian erotic taste is intransigent is decidedly not to say that it cannot be changed. Indeed, it's one of the cornerstones of feminism, broadly construed, I think, that the erotic value attached to women's subordination to men can and should be shifted. I think you can hold that position regardless of whether you think it's natural or not, or you have what kinds of stories you have about that. It's my view that the dominant form of pornography, which I call inegalitarian porn, plays an important role in sustaining inegalitarian erotic taste. But I also think that this commitment to the idea that pornographic pictures have special power to shape their audience's erotic taste entails a commitment to not merely tolerating, but even championing a particular sort of pornography, which many people call feminist pornography. Pictures can coax us into finding relations marked by gender equality to be sexy, attractive, pleasurable, and desirable, much as we are all slowly being coaxed to find high-waisted jeans to be flattering and attractive. Okay, so I'm going to turn briefly to these points in the final section, and let me see, I have 5 minutes? I have less than 5 minutes. So I'll just tell you. I'm just going to tell you about the end of this paper. So I have been developing what I call an Aristotelian model of habituation to think about. So I've been trying to convince you that pictures call for these sentimental responses and that these are evaluative and that they can be persuasive in this way. But the case that I haven't made up to this final section that I'm just going to tell you about is how it is that pictures can have lasting effects on someone's disposition to desire. And so I think this is where an Aristotelian picture of habituation comes in. And very interestingly, Aristotle, when he's talking about how you can cultivate dispositions to feel, in a couple of key places, like the Poetics and in the Politics and a little bit in the Rhetoric, says, you know, mimetic representations, by which he doesn't, I mean, he does mean pictures, but he doesn't really talk about pictures. But I think pictures are the perfect example here. Mimetic representations can get a person to feel the right feeling and with the proper intensity and direct it toward the right kind of object, and that doing that over time doesn't, it's not like operant conditioning, it gets someone to see the value to be had somewhere. And so it's inculcating a way of perceiving, a kind of value-laden perception. So that's a view that I like to bring together with all of this thought about pictures. And then in the last section of the paper, I just go back to this point that I think if we're committed to the idea that pornographic pictures can do tremendous harm by inculcating erotic taste and training that's trained on degrees of female subordination to men, then we ought to also be committed to the idea that pornographic pictures can help reshape erotic taste in the direction of gender equality. And so I've been thinking about this for a while and learning more and more about the really vibrant field known as feminist pornography, which is really varied. And I gave a talk at a conference at the University of Kent in December and had the pleasure to meet my first real live feminist pornographer. And she gave a talk about how she'd picked up the work of Murray Smith, a philosopher at University of Kent who works on film, and she got very interested in what he has to say about empathy and antipathy, and that was really what got her working on her project in feminist pornography, so spurred by coming across some philosophy of art. And she's trying to make pictures that really encourage people to have erotic feelings about representations of women in powerful and strong positions with respect to sex, not in a fetishizing dominatrix way, but in this like genuine way with genuine representations of authentic female pleasure. And representing all types of women's bodies, so not just adhering to this like super skinny, large breast type, but really showing all of the different ways that women's bodies can be and women of different ages. And it was a really enlightening conversation. So I will stop there. Thank you so much for listening.